Good morning. Welcome to the OWEN podcast. We're a little bit sleep deprived this morning. We just had our first WWDC office sleepover. A handful of us crazy iOS Apple nuts stayed in the office so we could wake up at 3 a.m. to watch the WWDC keynote. My name is Kent Humphries. I'm the iOS team lead here at Outwear Mobile. And I'm joined by two other Apple nuts, Jean-Etienne Parot and Adam Sharp. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Why didn't you say my name with an accent?
And Adam Sharp.
Much better, thank you.
You're not French, so you don't get that privilege.
I'm insulted.
So we were good boys. We went to bed around midnight and tried to get a bit of sleep before the keynote started, which was very wise. I'm happy we did that.
Yeah, that was strategical, I think.
Yeah, we all wake up at three. We're a bit bleary-eyed, and we sat through probably an hour and 50 minutes of
pure
consumer-focused, yeah, front-facing sort of features, until we finally got to the real meat of the keynote presentation, as far as we're concerned as developers. So I'm going to ask you this. I know what the answer is. What was the most significant announcement that Apple made this morning?
I don't want to steal the star of the show. I'm going to settle for another very big announcement for me. I think is the opening of the Touch ID API. I think. It can create a new ecosystem of apps that will use Touch ID as the main identity for the app. So you don't need to have a Facebook login or Twitter login or even create a new username and password with all those passwords that we discussed in another podcast. And I think that's a great thing. It's probably going to be on the Apple exclusive identity, but maybe they will open something. I don't know, but it's a good thing that it simplified it at least.
Yeah, I got the impression it's... So I just want to state here, we all stayed up and watched the keynote and we haven't read any more of the background information because we didn't want to be tempted with NDAs and whatnot.
This is very fresh.
This is all our speculation as of about 4 hours.
It may even be more unreliable than you would otherwise expect.
I just want to flag that.
From an analytical type like us.
I got the impression that the Touch ID... So it's going to unlock your keychain for you. So to me, it isn't necessarily tied to an identity, as in I could log into an app and say, well, this is what I want to use to unlock this app, and I use my thumbprint, and then I give the phone to someone else and they might install a different app and they might say, for this app, this is the thumbprint I want to use to open this app. What do you think? Do you think I've maybe skewed it wrong?
It's just as much about identity as a password is. A password is something that, in theory, only you are supposed to know, and therefore it identifies you as being who you say you are, if you can produce that password. But it's still down to the developer of the application to correctly unlock the features that are authorized and should only be enabled to just you. So in the same way, if you register your fingerprint to unlock features of the app, then that gives you a way to say, I'm the only one who's allowed to see those features.
But do you think there'll be multiple thumbprints can be assigned to one device, or do you think it'll be locked to you've sort of taught your thumb to this device to unlock the device, therefore it has to be the same thumbprint within any app on that device?
Yeah, I think that's the direction they're taking is it's your device, it's your thumbprint, and
it can unlock
they stated very clearly, I think, they don't want to be accused again of breaching privacy. So they stated that the thumbprint will be inside the chip. Mm-hmm. And it won't be shared with third-party apps, not even within the rest of the OS. So I think it's more of the device will let the app know that it's okay. The OS will just say, it's okay, I've granted access, you can trust me, I'm the OS. Mm-hmm. And the app will say, okay, well, cool. And maybe, I hope, like, I can see that working with the new Cloud Kit that they announced, where it will say, okay, you can grant access, you can trust me, and just take this token and that's the identity handle for your session.
Well, I feel like let's talk about CloudKit. Sorry, Adam. We will get to your highlight of the keynote in just a minute. But CloudKit I think is really interesting. They're basically taking a big swipe at PaaS, Microsoft Azure, I think to a degree, and sort of AWS. So there's a lot of web services out there that exist for developers who don't have a backend for their app. So basically, their app is a front end to some connected information that needs to be stored on the internet somewhere. And, you know, it's expensive to get a web server. It's not a trivial thing to set up a web service and be able to access your data from anywhere where there's internet. And so these other third parties have been, you know, giving you options. I think PaaS is kind of probably the most direct competitor to this. That's a company that Facebook bought, which it basically lets you set up a really simple database that you can access anywhere with the internet.
It looks like they went front to front competing with PaaS with this CloudKit. But we'll see when we have more NDA protected information to what exactly they offer
that we won't be able to talk about. I think from the slide, like I you know, it was kind of the basic things. You can have a database. There's a simple sort of key value data store. And what was interesting is they said it was something like it's free
with
most of the time. Or it was like out the corner of their mouth. It was like mostly. So I think it'll be free for anyone who's, you know, unless you're making the number one selling app on the App Store and you're getting millions of downloads a day. I got the impression it won't cost you anything, which is quite significant.
And just to even give a little bit more detail on that, Craig Federighi did say that he indicated that with limits condition to it being free is very strongly tied to the number of users who are using your app and your service. So as you're, you know, if you're starting a company and you want to grow a service and have a user base and have a community and it's growing, you shouldn't have to worry that all of a sudden Apple are going to hit you with all these extra fees because your capacity should scale as your number of users grows.
And the good thing about Apple being, you know, the ones making this is that it's in their interest to have really successful apps. So there have been startups where they're like, we're going to store all of your certain data on our servers, and as soon as they scale to a certain point, the cost of storing that data just got prohibitively expensive. So assumedly Apple have looked at this and sort of modeled it and decided, well, you know, if we make it free up until this point and then, like you said, scale it reasonably, you know, it's making their ecosystem stronger because they can get these hot little startups that go from nothing to a million users in 6 months, and they won't be sort of knocked out as soon as they hit a certain threshold. They won't be knocked out by the server costs.
But what do you think? They said with limitations, but we don't have a clear number. I think they say you can have until a petabyte of storage or something like this, which is huge. But let's say with the growing number of people using iOS, maybe you don't even need to be the number one app to reach one petabyte. Maybe it's going to be the 10 or 100 top grossing apps on the store that will reach that.
But so assumedly those 10 or 100 grossing apps have enough revenue to...
But does it mean that if you want to transition to a different storage, from the start you have to think of a transition? First you use iCloud for the first
CloudKit,
for the first million users, and when you reach 2 million users, you know that iCloud
can't support that. That's probably, to me, that makes sense, because if an app or a startup got to that size where, you know, the server costs from Apple are becoming prohibitive, then surely they would want to own that space anyway.
Yeah.
So they would want to be in charge of their servers, and they would want to, basically have the control to scale in the way that's most effective to them. I'm sure, you know, AWS, which is a service provided by Amazon where you just pay for, you know, server space, basically they're highly competitive, and a lot of things like PaaS probably is on some of Facebook servers, but a lot of sort of higher level web services are based on AWS. So I could imagine you hit a certain price threshold with Apple and you say, look, we're getting so big, we can't let Apple control this part of our app. We need to own that ourselves. So we can be cross-platform as well. That's another thing. If you buy into this, I assume, well... We don't actually know if you can get it to work with Android, for example.
Yeah, and this is the concern that I do have, is that historically, anything branded iCloud is purely Apple only. Even to the extent that on, say, if you're developing a Mac app, anyone can write a piece of software and ship it over the internet and someone can download it and run it on their Mac. But if you want to use iCloud in your app, you actually have to go via the Mac App Store. Mm. So it's very different. The whole premise of iCloud is it's connecting your Apple devices together and making that seamless, and you should never have to think about syncing your data and things like that. And I do wonder if that is a model that can meet the many different kinds of app or service that people might want to create.
I guess. Yeah.
And so the challenge is you might start with your iOS app and develop it, and I want to be able to have my users sync their data between their iPhone and their iPad, or even from their iOS device to their Mac. And that's great, but what if you then want to branch out and go to Android? Is there... I would be surprised if CloudKit would ever be open to that. But having said that, Apple have been doing a lot, so who knows? Maybe they'll surprise us, but I'm not holding my breath.
It also depends like how clean that web... it's a web service, so... If that web service is clean and it just has, you know, a bunch of API calls, there's no reason why an Android device can't make those web calls unless they implement some sort of token authorization sort of thing. And, you know, they could do that.
And they definitely didn't pitch it from that side of things, which, the kind of logical conclusion is that it probably won't support that.
And the thing worth pointing out is they're going after a certain sector of the market. So, you know, all the clients that we work with, they want to maintain their own web service. So either they have an existing one because they're sharing their data between a website, iOS app, Android app, you know, whatever other native apps, or we build that middleware for them. So I can't see, for example, you know, the kind of industry, companies that we work with, they're not going to be using this service. It's going to be for the little scrappy startups who want to prove that their app works. And I guess that will be enough to get them funding and enough to get them a certain amount of people actually using their app, prove the concept, and then maybe they can go and build out their own back end and go cross-platform and things like that. I think it's smart of Apple to be filling this gap, but you know, there were existing other competing services, so they're just kind of coming in and swiping them out of the way.
They just provide an easier solution for the developers to use. That's why I think it's more targeted for startups and indie developers.
Mm, yeah, definitely.
To help you kickstart the project and have a product shipped really, really early, and then you can iterate on that. And if you need to iterate and migrate to Amazon Web Services, which is probably the long-term solution, then you can do that later. But at least for the first couple hundred thousand users, you can stay with iCloud.
Okay, so I'm aware you two have only got about another 10 minutes before you need to run off. We're going to have a bit of a rotating host panel group discussion today. So you guys are here to give us the technical beef to kick things off. So Adam, what was your highlight of the WWDC presentation?
Well, there's kind of two... The thing that affects me the most is a pretty big announcement, something that's going to affect the Apple ecosystem and the development community a lot. And I was trying really hard not to say the Objective-C development community. these guys know why. It's because Apple is replacing Objective-C with a brand new programming language, which we should have seen coming, but none of us thought to predict it.
Can I quote Craig Federighi? The language is called Swift, and it totally rules.
and for a few seconds... or maybe a few minutes, the new brand new Wikipedia page said that too. Said it's a new language and it rules something like this, and it's being quickly edited.
So Jed and I actually had, in the wee hours of this morning, we frantically were downloading the whatever build SDK, of Xcode, yeah. the SDK that we could get our hands on to try this out. And I did have a play around with it, and it's just, it's very different when you're familiar with Objective-C.
You had a play in the playgrounds? Is that what you mean?
So, Jed is alluding to one of the new features. So, maybe I can give a high-level breakdown of what's actually different.
Yeah, so just, with the new programming language. And sort of explain a bit about, you know, where Objective-C came from and where this takes us to, I guess.
So, Objective-C is, in a word, ancient. It's been around since... I don't actually know when it started, but
years or so? Yeah.
As far as the Apple developer ecosystem is concerned, it started with the Next Step days, Steve Jobs' company that he founded when he left Apple. And so all their tools were built with Objective-C, which is a language based on C, which is even older. And so... even though there were some really modern, nice features in Objective-C, that features that developers accustomed with more modern languages might expect, mm-hmm. It also came with a lot of baggage from its C heritage. And so there has just been a growing discontent, I would say, from my on the internet over the past few years. I think it's been getting not quite fever pitch, but every 6 months or 12 months it comes around again. Oh, Apple should fix Objective-C. Mm-hmm. They should replace it with a new language. Oh, what language is it going to be? Is it going to be Ruby? Is it going to be something completely different? Are they going to go back to the Java days? What's going to happen? So turns out Apple have had something in the works. They suggested it's for quite some time now.
Yeah, I'd love to know how many years they've been building their apps in both Swift and Objective-C. It's probably like, it could be like 2 or 3 years. Who knows? They've kept it completely secret.
And in their documentation, they indicate that all of the shifts in the platform and developer tools over the past, say, 4 or 5 years have been very much to support the transition to this new language and tool set. They extended C with new features to support blocks, also known as closures. They added some modern syntax to Objective-C. They added ARC, automatic reference counting, which went a long way, I think, towards solving some of the memory management woes, which is one of the first things that new iOS developers or Mac developers, the brick wall they hit is, what's all this manual memory management stuff? I don't want to have to deal with this. I don't want to have to think about it. So all of those shifts, Apple indicated, were actually in preparation for this new language,
and
Swift.
Historically, Apple has been, they've made some major transitions over the past like 10 or so years. So, you know, going from OS 9 to OS 10, Sharpie, I didn't say OS X, just for you. Going from OS 9 to
OS
10.
I'm not going to congratulate you for saying the right thing. That should be the default position.
I just say OS X, whatever. Going from OS 9 to OS 10, that was a massive transition. And, you know, they sort of handled that over 1 or 2 years. Then they went from the PowerPC to the Intel chips. Again, that was... you know, huge to change the chip architecture that your software runs on. It's no mean feat, and I think they did that over 2 or 3 years, and then everyone was just kind of like, oh, okay, that was easy. Let's move on. And then 32-bit, 64-bit, completely painless. Like on iOS, that transition's still happening, and it's completely invisible essentially to users.
Almost
invisible. And I think again they've set it up in such a way that this is going to be a very seamless transition. So we still have backwards compatibility, so we can write projects in Objective-C, C, Swift. We can sort of mix all those languages, and essentially the compiler will compile them all to a common, I don't know, machine code, whatever. And the runtime hasn't changed. I think that was an important thing they said. So when you're actually running the app and debugging, you won't have a vastly different experience there, I think. So it's kind of really exciting for developers. It changes the way we work because the programming language is the bit where we spend, you know, our day. That's our language. Yet it's not necessarily going to have any impact, negative impact on users.
And I kind of like the approach that they are. It may sound a bit childish, but they are working us. They are holding our hand. And if you said, Adam, that you read in the documentation that it was in preparation for the transition that they added some features to Objective-C. And it kind of makes sense that slowly, bits after bits, they add stuff that is less and less Objective-C and more Swift. Now in hindsight, we can realize that it was more Swift.
And also the transition to iOS 7 last year. So they sort of pushed auto layout and UI dynamics. So there's that physics element of the operating system. So last year was a very front-facing set of changes. So the things that the developers had to learn was all about the way the apps look and feel for users. This year, it looks like they haven't barely touched that. They've kind of left the look and feel alone, and instead they're focusing on this, you know, the dev side of the fence. So we don't have to learn, you know, whole entire new user interface APIs and also a new programming language, which that seems nice of them.
And yeah. They seem to have taken great pains to ensure compatibility between the, as of yesterday, current set of dev tools and programming environment and the new tools. So just a quick rundown, high level of new features that this actually enables. One of the big new ones is there's a new type system, and basically there's two kind of implications for developers. One is you have to write less types in your code. You don't have to say this is a number, this is a string, this is a point, this is a rectangle, you know. You don't have to specify in a lot of different cases. The compiler can actually just work out, oh, I know what you're doing. I know what data type you're supposed to be dealing with here. So it just figures it out and works it out automatically.
Ruby, Python have been doing for years, right? So it's kind of playing catch up, essentially.
It's interesting, actually. Those two are actually completely dynamic. They go the other way. They just say everything's the same as everything else. There's no such thing as types. You take you treat something of one data type as a different data type. If at runtime we can figure out a logical way to make that conversion, we'll do it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we'll just throw an error. Whereas this goes the other way, and types are still there, and they're actually even more expressive than they had been. And as well as being more expressive in saying, here's the types of data I expect, it also takes the work off developers because there's fewer times where you're going to have to explicitly type out those types.
You just kind of write what you want and the compiler will, you know, do the work for you.
Yeah.
So one last thing, we haven't got much time. The idea of playgrounds. So they've kind of made like a little area where you can, I guess, try out your code and sort of interact with it in real time.
So one of the biggest pain points of Objective-C development is the kind of compile, run, test cycle. And especially when you're, say, testing on a device, you've got to compile, bundle everything together, ship it to the device, wait for it to load, test, and then do it all again. And that's kind of a large feedback loop. So one of the new features is called Playgrounds, and it's basically you can just start typing code into a document and Xcode will constantly keep evaluating that code, and alongside every statement that you write, it will print the output from that statement. And so you can just interactively type stuff out, practice, oh, I've got an error, I'll try something different, all that kind of thing. And it makes it a lot more interactive and gives you a lot more feedback during the process.
They had some graphs and things. Do you think that's going to be a bit gimmicky and we might not actually use that? Do you think it's kind of, in a perfect scenario, a graph is a really great way to visualize your data, but will it really be smart and useful in everyday programming, do you think?
Sometimes I'm a bit old school about this kind of stuff, and I think, oh, all you need is a keyboard and uh, and a text editor, mm-hmm. and that's all you need. But I think it can help also realize that we can develop, and we don't need to be like old school gurus that say, "Oh no, developing back in my days, developing was like this. It should remain like this for the rest of computer science life." Mm-hmm. I think that's great that they provide more tools and newer, different alternative tools. I'm not sure I'm going to use it tomorrow, but maybe we will reorganize the dev pipeline to make more use of that, or maybe tweak stuff at the latest stage, yeah. where it makes more sense when you know what the app looks like.
And at worst, it looks like a good learning tool. So when we're trying to learn the ins and outs of Swift, it looks like a really easy way for us to check that we're doing the right thing without having to build a whole app, compile it, or run it on the simulator. We can get that quick feedback.
Yeah, I'm wondering if this playground feature will work in the app code itself, or mm-hmm. if it's only like just a console, like to test out like a few statements, and then you continue coding on your app, yeah. or if you can actually like put a breakpoint in your app and just start live editing your app.
Well, I did see on the slide one of the items in the bubble of features was a REPL, and for those who don't know, that's an acronym. It stands for Read Val Print Loop. So basically, it's an interactive prompt. You type some code, you get the it evaluates it and prints a result. You type it again, it evaluates it, prints a result. And there's a real benefit to, if you've got a running app, you hit pause and just start playing around, seeing what the app currently looks like, what data is there, what objects are flying around, who knows what, and you can test things out and get some visibility into what actually is going on in your code.
So it all comes down to basically developers will be more empowered and we should get paid more.
That's a very good segue.
In essence, yeah.
That's a very good segue.
I just want to... This one last thing. Adam, I noticed that in the playground, he started writing some things and then he went import Coco and then did some Coco commands. Does this imply this could be our scripting language of choice potentially? Could this replace Ruby?
It probably could.
Ruby holds a special place in your heart. Could it be displaced?
There's a lot of other things that I love about Ruby that I don't know if anything could dislodge its place in my heart.
Not there yet, Swift.
Not for the foreseeable future. But in any case, there's a simple... One of the nicest things about Ruby is that you can just dump some code in a file and run it and see what happens. Mm-hmm. And you can actually do that now with Swift. You can just have a file and every statement, you used to have to define like a main function and had to have
proper things, it's the C kind of
heritage and make sure that you had the right arguments and that you were calling the right things and return the right value and all this kind of complexity when you just want to get some code running and see what happens. And that kind of workflow should at least be possible, if not common, you know. I think to date, doing that with Objective-C, just to me, it seemed like a waste of time.
Just too heavy.
Yeah. Why go through the contortions of trying to use Objective-C and the Coco frameworks when I can just use Ruby and it's got some really nice expressive APIs and things, and I can just write some code and see what happens and get working really quickly. I think if the community really gets behind this language, we could see similar kind of tools coming out for Swift.
Yeah.
And I really hope they do. And I hope that people take the kind of modern features. Like, there's a lot of new features that we just didn't have in Objective-C. You just read the introduction. They have a book that teaches you Swift, and mm-hmm. you just read the introduction, and it's like, wow, all these things I've been wishing I had them for years, and now they're kind of there. So I think it should open up the doors for developers to create some really good tools, and I think I can see this only being a good thing for the community.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to write down, I think a few months from now, we should do a Swift podcast and just talk about Swift for 45 minutes. But I know you guys have to run. Any final words before you jet off?
introducing the new language now is quite a good timing, actually, because for a while Objective-C was only for Mac dev and not many people would write apps for Mac, for the Mac platform. Since the introduction of the App Store, iOS App Store, there's been, of course, more and more iOS devs trying to learn the language and developing more apps. And I have a feeling that recently the community around iOS development has been quite active. And there's a level of maturity of understanding Objective-C, the language, and tweaking it and adding really interesting third-party libraries and stuff like this. I think that this momentum can easily be ported to Swift and make it, because the language seems to be easier and more extendable, I think that could be really good, that many people will port their libraries and maybe have new ideas of new features to add to the language and extend it even higher.
It's an exciting time to be an iOS dev. Let's leave it at that.
Something we didn't even touch on as well is the new inter-app communication and sharing options that developers now have available to them. Obviously, Swift affects me directly a lot, and I'm really excited about that. But I think in terms of the platform, that's potentially even bigger because, you know, we wait year after year for Apple to do these big releases and give us a new thing and something shiny and new. And we had a whole whiteboard filled with predictions of all the shiny new things that we would get over, you know, last night. But these inter-app communication tools that Apple have now opened up to us, I think the potential for the platform to grow in even unintended ways now, it's like that seed is being sown.
Yeah, yeah.
And once developers get behind those tools, you'll new third-party apps come out and your phone or your iPad will get better in unintended ways,
yeah, exactly.
Outside of the regular Apple rumor mill and the product,
the developers cycle. We've got a lot more power than we usually in each iOS update. It's very rare to get this much new functionality in the hands of devs.
Yeah,
it's very exciting.
I'd like to add one last final thought.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that as of today, there is no such thing as a senior iOS dev. We are all junior, all over again, and this is kind of good for me because I still consider myself a junior dev, and no, we are all the same. We all have to relearn almost everything.
Jet, I don't think that's true. I think there are some things that are just innate.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so you'd be a mid-junior, right? And a remainder junior.
It's a good point. We've all got some learning to do. And I've said it before, as software engineers, we thrive on learning. Like, that's a massive part of our job and what draws us to this field. So, exciting times. I'm going to let you guys head off. You've got some important work to be doing. And I'm going to grab in some of the slightly less technical outwarians to talk about, you know, things that aren't Swift. Even though I'd happily talk about Swift for another hour with you guys. So thank you, Jet. Thank you, Adam.
Thank you. Thank you, Kent.
Thank you very much, Kent.
Cheers. You are still listening to the OWEN podcast with me, Kent Humphries. And now I've gotten rid of the devs and I've got in our big hitters to talk about the slightly less technical aspects.
Did you hear that, George? We're big hitters.
Yes, yes. Of iOS 8 and OS 10 Yosemite. Look at that. I've already learnt the names. Peter Collins, welcome.
Hello. Hello. Very excited to be here.
George Hartley, welcome.
Hello and good morning.
And Danny Gorog.
Hello.
Howdy. And I want to say all you guys, Pete and George, you were here at the Atware slumber party.
Indeed.
And Danny came into the office just so he could watch the keynote with us.
I walked in, I was like, I felt like you were my family. And I was like, I can't wake them up. They were all asleep. Did you hear me come in?
And then
I got in about 2:30.
And then I woke up from the flash of a camera.
Yeah.
the best way to wake up.
I'll post that online.
What I love is that previous years, Danny, you've always woken up in the middle of the night to watch these things. And I've always thought you were crazy. But this year we were all crazy together.
So excited.
Yeah.
This is the game for us, isn't it?
Yeah,
this is like the pinnacle. These are the guys who are creating the stuff that we do every day. And it's so exciting. It was so exciting for me to actually share it with everyone. Like, you know, I've never watched a keynote like that with anyone before.
Yeah, it was terrific.
And we were talking during the keynote about how hard it used to be to watch a keynote. Before Apple started, had the Apple TV and started the live streaming.
The internet was good enough.
That's right. I mean, it was a perfect image.
Like, it was perfect.
It was ridiculous.
It was really good. Really good way to watch it.
Tim Cook in 1080p.
Yeah.
Just what we want.
And the hair.
And the hair. Craig Federighi. Yeah.
He's great. He was. Shout out to Craig Federighi. Yeah. He's great.
Is he a potential? I know Tim Cook's probably got another 30 years in him.
But I just love how Tim shares it around.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were all kind of... It's not the same as Steve was. It's still not quite there.
Yeah.
I think Steve was a lot more of a showman than Tim
Cook.
He
just had that, didn't he?
But
he
sort of Craig is a great demoer. And he really... I think he's got a personality. And I think the devs like him. And he's...
He appeals to a lot of people.
So we just had Pete and Jet in... Pete? Not everyone's called Pete. We just had Adam and Jet in, and we're talking about Swift and basically sort of ranting about how this is a huge announcement and, you know, our whole world's changed and we're just so excited to get started with these things. From a non-dev point of view, so we've got PM, UX director / co-founder. From a non-dev point of view, what was your take on the keynote?
So... One thing that really got me excited was, I think they called it continuity.
Uh-huh.
So that
was... Continuous? Yeah, or whatever it is.
Continuous continuity. Yeah, and so that's when you're browsing on one device and you can just pick it up straight away across the next. So you're on your computer on Safari and then you see it on your iPad, which is kind of cool if you use Safari. And I'm always tempted to go back and start using Safari.
I'm using Safari.
That's the catch with all those things. It's all... If you want that continuous experience from your Mac across the iOS device, you need to use Mail on the Mac, on iOS.
And Safari on Mac. It's probably enough to at least get me to you know, start again on Safari, again on the native Mail app and give it another crack.
Wow. And I think that the big key part of that was the tethering they talked about. They've sort of taken away the annoyance of tethering. Like, they've just kind of made it this instant thing that will just work. Well, knock on wood, we'll see if it does actually just work.
They've never let us down before.
Yeah. So, assuming it does actually work, it will. I've had this frustration for the past 2 or 3 years where I'm sitting there doing something on my computer and my phone is 10 centimeters away from me and they just won't talk to each other. And I've got to like send an email.
Or there's a passcode lock on your phone, you know? And then, because I don't have 5S, I've got a 5, and then you've got to go through that, go into your settings. And so that's really cool if you just flick it straight on without even accessing your phone.
It takes away that friction. It makes it sort of one device with multiple screens, almost. You know, that's the kind of direction we're heading in.
And further to that, though, picking up calls from my computer seems so futuristic.
That's cool.
As a kid in the 90s, I couldn't fathom that. And now it looks seamless. You can just pick your call up. You're on your laptop and just start talking on your laptop.
Yeah, and that's really SMS cool. as well, which is kind of cool to be able to sit there sending an SMS at your keyboard.
Yeah. And get actual green bubbles as well to our Android friends.
But it just seems like it's going to bring so much, like a really super cool new piece of functionality to an iPad, say. Like I can make calls from it now. I can be there, my phone can be somewhere else entirely, and it doesn't matter. I can just call George. Hi, George. I'm done. That's cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool. That is really, really cool. So.
Kind of amazing. Collins, you're a... Pete Collins. You're a Android user.
I am.
And what did you think about the third-party keyboards? Is that tempting you?
Do you use a swipe keyboard? I use a swipe keyboard at the moment. Yeah, like, and I've really got used to it. I find it really kind of quick to type on. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm interested to see what they've done with the keyboards, actually.
Could that be enough to... Are you...
No, it's not going to be...
Pete's getting an iPhone anyway.
I am actually. This is... I feel like last night was a kind of defining moment in my in my life as a mobile user. I will be... You heard it here first, coming back to the light side of iOS.
Da, da, da.
So, I thought it was... I thought it was a really great keynote. I think it was... I think it was... maybe a bit easy to get caught up in a lot of really huge rumors like iWatches and new cinema displays and all sorts of stuff. But I think I was just
we had a whiteboard with all our predictions, and
there were some pretty crazy ones there.
A lot of fails.
Yeah, like, a lot of big fails. But I think George made a good point just before he came in. He said there was just lots of kind of slightly smaller things, but it all added up to like a really what should hopefully be a really cool experience when it's all out. The big one of the two big things for me were opening up the Touch ID. That was really I thought that's really big.
We touched on that a bit with Jen and Adam.
So I think that's really cool. And then AirDrop between your phone and your computer.
It's just
that
thing. It's like they've gone, what are the friction points?
Yeah, when exactly. You're using
a tablet, a phone, and a computer. What are the things that just annoy you and just piss you off and just make you want to go, why doesn't this work better?
Yeah, yeah.
And that seems to be the glue that's what they've addressed.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the thing. It's nothing like it's nothing major. It's just how can we make these little things
A great
better.
Example is the mail drop. So sending really big attachments. It's all it's doing. It's uploading your file to iCloud and it's sending a link to that file. And it's a really simple thing. You can do it already using Google Drive, using Dropbox, using all these tools. But the fact that they're putting it right there in mail, it just takes away any friction.
Yeah. I think the story of today was about the power of kind of combining these two platforms and how when you've got a single vendor like Apple, you can do that stuff. And I think the only other people, you know, we're sitting on the couch at 3 a.m, and the only other company in the world that actually can do this stuff is Google, and maybe Microsoft.
Yeah.
And then they're the three. There aren't any other companies in the world who can do this. And what I also found really interesting was the lack of mention of Google products in the Apple keynote.
Yep.
And I just saw today that one of the default search providers is now DuckDuckGo, and Apple are promoting that. Because DuckDuckGo have much better privacy policies than Google do. And it's unbelievable how powerful you can be if you own the platform. So, you know, Apple could change the default to Yahoo or DuckDuckGo and suddenly a lot of Google users are finished.
Well, the mobile users.
And that's where the users are.
Just plummet.
Yeah. So I think that's really, really interesting. And I think you're seeing Apple starting to flex their muscles a bit. You know, they keep building maps. They keep building the messaging. They're really building out their own platform.
Do you think, because obviously Bing Translation was one of the things they touched on as well, and a couple of new Bing services that they've kind of baked into iOS. But there was the one mention I saw of Google was still searching in Safari.
Yeah.
Do you think, is that just a contractual thing? Like, do you think?
I think it's probably it's still the best user experience. Yeah. And I think Apple, that's ultimately what they're driven by.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think you're seeing them peel back the Google stuff all the time.
Yep, the Google onion.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting just how many devices there are out there, 800 million devices. And what was the stat, like 47% of users were new to iOS this year in the last 12 months?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
I mean, they're mega, those numbers.
Yeah, that's
mega.
Crazy, yeah. And 500 million iPhones or something sold last year or something.
No. Ever. 100 million. I mean, these numbers are just like they're really hard to fathom.
Yeah. And you mentioned there about the fact that they own the platform, but they're also diving into HealthKit and HomeKit, which are areas where they don't own the platform. So, do you think that's?
Well, I think they're going to define. I think that's what's so exciting because they get to define the platform. And I think, you know, health is one of those areas. You know, it'd be great to have a universal health record where, you know, you go to one doctor, you go to another doctor, and you get to share it all, and the government holds that information. But people are kind of insanely insecure about giving that information to anyone. But if you could have that information programmatically stored on your phone securely behind Touch ID, I think people would be like, I could deal with that.
We actually talked about that on the first on podcast, I think, with Collins.
Yeah,
George. Yeah, we actually talked about the fact that your phone becomes the repository for all your data, and your doctor taps into it, and that's the model. Healthcare. Yeah.
So how far away from that do you think we realistically are, though? In a kind of real world scenario,
because look at all the American hospitals we're partnering with.
Yeah.
You know, all these things. It's a platform, so you don't suddenly guarantee that every iOS user uses HealthKit. Mm. You only guarantee it if the Fitbit and Nike and all these guys happily talk to it. And the doctors and the clinics and things get the data back off it. So it's an experiment, but I think they're the first. Samsung haven't really, they didn't make it a platform in this
way. Right? I mean, these are the first guys who are doing it mainstream, and if anyone's going to get traction, it's going to be Apple.
To be honest, though, on health, the health app and the home, remember the home kit app, it seemed the health app itself was actually, there wasn't that much that they kind of shared, and they may not be that far along with it. Whereas the home one felt like...
Well, the home one I thought was interesting because they really, the hook they've given developers is if you use this home kit, you get to use Siri. And that's like a... Even developers don't have access to Siri. Mm. And so that's really the pull, you know, get on board and we'll let you use Siri. And that's a really kind of interesting trade-off. But I think health, you know, I think health will be... you'll see a lot of traction with health.
Yeah.
Because I think... The companies, there are only a few big companies, and I think they'll want to be promoted by Apple. They'll want to sell their stuff in Apple stores, and so Apple have a lot of sway.
Mm.
Essentially, they're making money through hardware. That's how they make. Mm. That's how the people who are making the smart scales and the Fitbits and the apps and all that stuff. That's how they're making the money.
Yeah, I don't doubt that what Apple will do in that space will be really big. My worry is the government and, you know, public hospitals, and these aren't people that you typically associate with being fast movers in the technology sector. Yeah. And it'll take 5-10 years for them to actually start. You know, when somebody comes in with a phone and says, "Oh, here's my data," and they don't look at you like you've got two heads.
But I guess
that'll take a long time.
I guess Apple's provided like a default for them. So if a hospital is thinking, "Well, how can we better integrate with our consumers and take advantage of mobile?" Apple's got a solution.
Yeah. And if you think about, you know, when you use Passbook, you go to Eventbrite and you book a ticket and they send something to your phone, that notification to your phone, and then it goes into Passbook. The same sort of thing could happen.
Did that get traction, Passbook?
I think so. I use it when I can use it, it's available. Yeah. You know, it works for Virgin, it works for Qantas, it works for Jetstar. I don't have it. They've got SMS check-in. It works for Eventbrite. Mm-hmm. But if you think about going for a doctor's visit, and, you know, they take notes on the visit and they press a button and you get a notification to your mobile phone, you tap it and that record goes into your health book. I don't think that's too far away.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
It's exciting. So with the HomeKit, I think that's a slightly different beast because you've got, you know, with HealthKit, it's all software. So we've got all these different apps and they're all talking to the one HealthKit app. But HomeKit, it's hardware. You know, it's these IP, internet-enabled hardware devices. So I'm concerned that Apple might fail here. Google's basically tried. They had Google Home or something. We talked about this on an earlier podcast. Google's tried twice, essentially, to try and get into the home automation field and hasn't made it
but
yet.
I think Apple have more sway in the space. You know, you think about the people who are installing these high-end homes with high-end automation.
Paying $100 for a light bulb.
They are all...
They're all going to have
iPhones. They're all going to have iPads. They've all got Apple TVs hooked in. And I think Apple, again, have... I haven't really read all about it.
Yeah, yet, I don't know how it sort of works.
It seems like they're kind of dictating a standard. They're saying, if you want to get on this HomeKit stuff, this is how your device needs to talk to the network.
And
this
They do have some success in that area with the, AirPlay speakers.
Made for iPod, made for iPhone programs. That is quite a big standard.
You go to a music shop or, you know, a hi-fi shop and everything has a dock or, you know, it's all about how it integrates.
The made for iPod program was huge. And the made for, you know, to be able to sell your kit in the stores and have your stuff promoted on the App Store is massive.
Hmm.
You can't underestimate how much traffic and business they can drive.
Just to change tack a little bit.
How excited are you now for Google I.O.? I mean, you're just there's so much cool stuff that comes out. Yeah. You know, I feel like this iOS 8 release has really helped Apple catch up to where Android were. You know, the widget stuff,
it was probably still
not as good as Android, but at least extensible now. Keyboards, third-party keyboards, third-party inter-app communication, what they call that, extensibility?
Yeah.
They're all the problems that were kind of drive you nuts as a user. The iCloud, iCloud storage. What do they call that? iCloud in the
cloud kit, I think.
Files in the cloud or something, whatever it is. But you know, like essentially a Dropbox or a Google Drive replacement, and how you can plumb that in directly into your app.
That is
killer.
Yeah.
That just
the Dropbox killer. Yeah.
Well, it's not Dropbox killer. It just makes it all easy.
Yeah. We talked about it. It's a PaaS.
It's interesting. Yeah. I've for the last 6 months I've used.
iCloud. You know, when I'm doing spreadsheets and documents at home, I use iCloud. I use Numbers. And it just is so seamless. It really is. Like, we don't use it here because it's not an enterprise grade product, but it's really seamless. Like, sit back on the couch with your iPad, make a change. It's available on your iPhone, and it just really works well.
Yeah, and the fact that those changes will, like, when you're doing it on your Mac, there'll be a little icon on your iPad just to instantly switch over. It's kind of substantial.
I think that looks better in the movies, in the videos, that it actually does. Maybe, it works in real life.
Maybe. We'll see. Well, I think
I don't know how many execs are kind of tapping away and email, and they sort of just sit down on their computer and bring it up. Like, you know.
You're working on something on the train and then you finish it. Yeah. I don't know. What, Danny, what do you think about the family sharing? You were a fan of this.
Well, I know. I mean, my kids are still pretty young, but we only have, everyone uses my account to buy stuff. But I know it's a big problem for lots of parents. You know, they give, you either give access, you give your kids access to your primary Apple ID and you tell them your password and they go nuts. Mm-hmm. Or you give them their own account and then you've got no control over it. So just that ability to link the accounts together, if your kid wants to buy an app, you've got to approve it. I think it's going to be huge.
And it could be helpful in like really small companies as well. If they've got an account, they could potentially, you know, share that with their three developers and stuff like that. Yep. So there's
it would just stop that horror story you hear every month of the $1,000 spent on Clash of Clans or whatever.
I mean, I don't know if you've seen that, but I've seen that with my family a lot. You know, my nephew, he just, you know, he says, "Nana, can I have your phone?" And like 2 days later, she gets a bill for $1,000 and he's bought like, you know, a million tokens. Yeah. Apple have been pretty good with that. They credit that back.
Yeah, I'd like to delve a little bit more into widgets and extensibility because I think they're huge. And Adam, before he sort of bought it up, but then they had to rush off. So we didn't get a time to really sort of, you know, cut into it. I guess if we talk about widgets first, because they're kind of, a little simpler to get
I just wanted
around.
To say congrats to Apple for inventing notifications and widgets.
Amazing.
I wanted to kind of talk about this actually because it's interesting that, you know, Google's done this for a while now, but yet I don't know what there's something about like Apple or there's something about the way Apple does it or the way Apple announces it or the way it works that everyone loves it. Like but it's not new. It's not new. But what is it about Apple? Like, why do people, as soon as Apple do it, think this is cool now, or this is good, or like,
yeah. I guess they do it in a nice slick video.
Well, is that it? Is it just a marketing?
Like a story? I mean, they just tell a really good cohesive story. Yeah. They're just good storytellers.
So like, I can suck you in. I can see those widgets, like, you know, majority of the apps that we work on having that instantly accessible information, having
really all the scored apps
right there,
exactly.
Having your balance for, you know, your NIB health insurance stuff, having that right there, all that kind of stuff.
Huge,
it's super exciting.
Yeah, huge.
And the extensibility. So this, it's like we're prophetic or something. In the future Apple podcast, I went on this big rant about how much friction there is to sort of edit a photo. So I was like, well, you have to go to the photo library and then you have to pull out the photo and then you have to go into your other app and then you have to import the photo and then you have to apply your filter and export it and then go back into Photos and there's your photo. And basically that was my rant, that this is a ridiculous amount of friction that you have. And that's exactly what Apple, like, that was the demo. That was the video.
Yeah.
I just want to say, I call that.
As a dev, Kent, can I ask you about any security concerns, I guess, between apps interacting with other apps?
Well, they've kind of introduced us to this idea with the activity sheet. So the, you know, when you click the funky share button thing, in your own app, you can add sharers for different features. So, you know, if I am building an app and I want to integrate a sharer for, I don't know, Pinterest, I guess was their example, but as of now, if I wanted to integrate Pinterest into my sharing, I could do that in my individual app. So I could get some code from Pinterest, and basically when I click a button, Pinterest would provide me with a little screen that I can, you know, upload my picture to Pinterest with. But the problem there was I had to add that Pinterest code to my own app. If I'm the guy that makes Pinterest, I couldn't get that added to every other app. Every app has to sort of, you know, actually bake that
uniquely in. Ask for that. Yeah.
So that's where it's flipped, and it's gone exactly the same as Android. Mm. So, you know, it's nothing new at all.
Yeah.
But it's exciting to finally have it on iOS. So I think it's okay because they've concentrated so much on that sandboxing. So I think it'll just kind of be a little mini app that runs, you know, well, it's not a mini app, but the experience will be as if you've got a little miniature trimmed down version of that app running inside another app. And I think they'll really lock down what you can get in and push out. So with the sharing window stuff now, you know, the way to do it in iOS 7, it's very locked down. You get an image and you can do things with that image, but that's the only thing that you get access to. So I think it'll be the same thing where if you're an image filter, all you will get is an image object. You do stuff and you spit out an image object. So, I mean, you could put an obscene image and return that. You could do things like that, but there's kind of, I don't think there's any vulnerability around passwords getting cracked or anything like that. If the actual programmer of the initial app, they're the one that chooses what data they're going to share.
Yep. I think that's all going to be super important on with healthcare. And they touched on that briefly about, you know, being very, very specific and careful about what you share with other apps from healthcare. Yep. So I think that's going to be...
But there was some talk of split-screen apps before. You know, there were some rumors and things. And I definitely didn't think that was a possibility. There's just so much complexity around having, you know, apps running at different sizes. It would just be a pain.
They sort of did a little bit of that with the ability to flick a draft email down and kind of go back to it. So I think they're trying to probably explore that model. Well, how do you get back to things from...
Yeah, and this extensibility, it... Like that mail example and extensibility, they kind of, they're ways for you to not have to use split screen apps. So rather than saying, you know, if you want to do Twitter while you're surfing, then have Twitter and Safari open at the same time sharing the screen. Instead, just bring up the little Twitter panel for the one Twitter thing you want to do and then go back to your business. So it's a slightly different model, I guess.
Yeah. There's been a heap of stuff. I've only just started to read some of the news articles about the keynote, but you know, they put up those slides where they, you know, they say 500 new APIs or 44,000, and they're all these words.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I noticed was this Wi-Fi calling, and apparently there's going to be an ability that it'll have to be coordinated with telcos. But basically, if you're on a phone call and you walk into a Wi-Fi network, it'll actually hand the call over to the data network and continue on the data network. So I think there's a whole lot of stuff they talked about today. But what's always exciting is how finding people keep digging and digging and finding these new features. The other thing we haven't talked about, you know, the multitasking. When you double tap the home button, you now get a list of your favorite contacts.
Yep. Yeah. Yep.
So that's really interesting as well, because I always want a fast way to, you know, to call my wife or whoever it is. And I just wonder if that's the right interaction model. I'm not convinced. I find it pretty hard to double tap.
I thought the UX on that was a bit odd for me as well.
Same.
Felt like they had this space. What are we going to do? Let's just put something just else convenient in there.
Yeah, yeah.
When it's nothing to do with multitasking between apps, which is what I...
It's kind of one of the things they got rid of. You know, we used to swipe left to get into Spotlight, and now that's sort of nothing. And I reckon there's so much space to put widgets or put something in that slot.
They could have used that. Well, I don't know about the UX of it, but from the point of view of I want to communicate with that person, then how am I going to do it? To me, they've got that the right way around. So what I hate is when I'm in my messages app and I'm, or I guess maybe I don't know if I want to call them or FaceTime them or message them or whatever, and I have to sort of choose an app and then choose a contact,
right?
Which is the wrong way around, because I know who I want to contact. I just need to choose how I want to contact them. So I think they've flipped that on their head, and that's absolutely right. They've flipped all our contacts on their heads. I'm glad about that. But yeah, whether or not my muscle memory will be a double tap is how you talk to your friends. I guess we'll see if it sticks or not.
Can I just highlight one other thing I'm just super excited about? And actually the reason I'm thinking about putting it iOS 8 on my phone. Hey Siri.
Yes.
Hey Siri. I use Siri all the time in the car. And you know, it's illegal to touch your phone. And I've actually thought to myself yesterday, I thought, you know what would be really cool? A Bluetooth button that you just press it, you stick it onto the steering wheel, you press it, and it fires Siri away. Because you can press buttons on your steering wheel.
Yeah.
Hey Siri. That's actually why I want to put
iOS Danny Gorog has a big smile on his face.
So excited.
Right about now.
I use Siri for every... I love Siri.
Yeah.
And I've got the male Siri in my car.
Interesting. Yeah. I personally think it's all a little bit naff. They're like, okay, Google, hey Siri. But I can see that. Well, you got when you're driving, you've got to interact with it somehow. So
yeah, I use Siri every day, like Danny driving. But yeah. I have it.
You plug in the white headphones,
Apple right? Headphones,
and you use it to text and call.
Only call, but every day I'll use it. Yeah,
like you just don't touch your phone.
No,
yeah,
it's illegal.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, exactly. two more things I want to talk about, which are kind of developer related. Video previews and test flight. So maybe we'll start with test flight and we can finish up with video previews because it's kind of something quite pertinent to us as a dev shop. So test flight. So Apple acquired test flight a few months ago or the company that owns test flight, but they acquired test flight, which is a beta app, beta testing app. So it lets you easily distribute apps, you know, outside of the app store while you're still testing. And I love the way that they presented it. They were just like, we've created this thing called TestFlight. Yeah. No, you bought it.
Yeah. I just wanted to turn to Pete and go, where's TestFlight for Android, man? Yeah.
But they have integrated it into the App Store, and I think it will be more of a seamless experience.
That's exciting.
The one
thing I'm worried is if will we lose functionality over simplicity.
Well, I'm interested. Are we still using it here in our continuous integration environment?
Yep.
I wonder if you'll still be able to kind of programmatically upload stuff to test flight.
Yeah, it might.
So that's might change. You know, that's a question.
Yeah, we'll have to keep our eyes.
But it's nice to see. I think it's always nice to see when companies buy technology and then, you know, they don't kill it.
It's not an acquire.
They build it in and do something with it.
Yeah, you're right. It is positive. And so video previews. I've listened to a few.
I was going to say one thing very quickly. Well, unrelated to TestFlight, but it was just the other really cool update that I thought for the App Store was bundles. I thought were very cool. Yeah, very, very cool. So as a developer or a producer of apps, or you know, if you produce kind of multiple related apps for the same client or something,
I guess
it's very cool that you could bundle them as a sports package or something.
Yeah, a few free apps.
Yeah, think of the Telstra stuff.
Exactly. Mm,
yeah.
That's the other thing that you kind of forget about Apple. They're very pragmatic. Mm. So they're trying hard to improve the App Store because that's where the developers are making the money and that's where the customers are trying to buy apps. So they've improved the search, they're doing bundles. So they're really trying hard to make it easy and reduce the friction to purchase.
One thing I noticed though, I'm worried that they're kind of still focusing on that thing where if you're not the number one hit, you won't get found. So for example, they showed in Spotlight, when you're searching, they'll search for apps on the App Store. But it looked like they would show you the top hit. So if I write recipe, whatever the most popular recipe app is, that's what I'm going
to
see.
Or the one that they give an editorial badge to.
Yeah. So, but in a way, they're making it harder to find. If you're in the top eight apps, maybe you'll never get seen unless you're in that number one spot. That's my concern.
Well, I think they tried to improve that. Instead of the right, left swipe to navigate between full screen apps, they've now got the sort of up, down swiping, which is easier to browse. People could probably go deeper. Yeah. And they also had related searches, I think.
It just choked you up, doesn't it?
Yeah.
No, it's emotional.
It really gets to me, these improvements on the App Store.
Searching for apps.
The App Store, I think, is one of the biggest pain points of the whole iOS sort of experience. Mm-hmm. I think it really needs improvements, so it's good that they're trying.
Yeah. So yeah, video previews. I remember listening to a podcast. I think it was Accidental Tech Podcast. I'm not sure. They talked about if you add a video preview, you kind of up the ante. So essentially everyone has to make a video preview now if you want to be considered, you know, a certain level of quality. So do you think they'll make tools and help us make those videos?
No.
It's just going to be up to you if you want to use it.
Yep.
So I mean, for someone like us, that's kind of fine because we'll have the resources to be able to do that when we need to do it.
But you don't need. I mean, you look at Kickstarter. There are a lot of people who can make funny. I don't think you need high production values to make a good video. You know, you just are they going to give us the tools to record?
Will they let you easily go? Okay, use your app for 10 minutes. We've made this little movie dump for you. I mean, you can already capture your screen with QuickTime. I guess there are enough tools already.
You just do it in the simulator.
In OS X that you can, you can kind of get around it.
Do you think there'll be a set of guidelines for the videos need to look like?
Their time. I'd rather they're working on something else than like a video capture.
Than the video preview. Yeah. Oh, for Apple. Yeah. Yeah, I guess there'll be guidelines. Like in the same way with the screenshots, I think you have to not be offensive. It's Apple. And things like that.
So yeah, well, it's,
They start with the guidelines and they work back.
Yeah. Guys, I think we've done an excellent tour of the... the dub announcements. Does anyone have anything We haven't talked about metal, but that's mostly for games. Mm. It's not so much what we do here.
It's too simple, all the OpenGL stuff for me. I don't want to spend time just talking about that low-level stuff.
Yeah.
It's
I think we've I made a list as I was watching the video last night, and we've covered the vast majority.
The video. You know what a video is, don't you?
What do you mean?
A set.
Video is still video. It's exciting times. Let's go out and download some of these things and start playing.
How many more podcasts are you here for?
That's a good question, Danny. I don't know if I've told the podcast listeners.
Don't go.
I'm heading off overseas soon. So in 2 weeks, what day is it?
Tuesday. So shout out to the UK if you're looking for a killer iOS dev
slash
who knows what's it called?
I've got 2 weeks.
Spirit, what's it called?
2 weeks to learn Swift.
Swift.
Expert. Yeah, I am so actually excited about that. I'm going to have a bit of a break, so I'm like, yes, I can learn Swift.
You've got a couple more weeks.
I've got a couple more weeks, and then I'm flying out to London to try and do some contract work and stuff over there. So, I will be no longer on the podcast, but I'm leaving it in safe hands. Talbo and Keith will be driving the ship.
Can I hijack the podcast for 2 minutes just to, because it raises an interesting point. How long do you think Apple will give us before you have to develop your apps in Swift? How long's the changeover going to be?
I think it'll be years.
Maybe
2 years.
Okay.
Really?
Yeah, I do.
So does that mean you'll have to go back and rewrite all your code?
If at that point, yeah.
Wow.
That's big. That's really big. Yeah, yeah, that's quite a... You think they'll push aggressively then to
move people over? They kind of, when iOS 7 came out, they really pushed that build it from the ground up, rebuild. So they've gotten developers used to the idea that everyone's going to migrate to the latest platform and we can afford to rebuild and be cutting edge.
When you compile code, when you compile Objective-C or Swift code, you get the same binary, don't you?
That's true. They don't have to get rid of it. But it's
like you can use C# and all these other cross-platform tools to combine to create.
Yeah, if it builds down to C, we can compile that. But I don't see them. I just don't think they'll want to support this weird environment with, you know, two main platforms. It's just much simpler for them if all their examples are in this language, and they don't have to support.
Yeah, so it's a matter. I don't know. I'm not sure it'll be two. Maybe I mean, longer, this feels like a big transition. You know, if you think about the PowerPC to Intel.
But we talked about that. Apple has, like, I literally said this to Adam and Jet before. They have such a great track record of just seamlessly doing it without anyone even blinking. Yeah. So, you know, they've set it up so that it won't impact users. And yeah, I guess it's just how long they want to give Objective-C, how long a life they want to give it.
Mm.
We'll see.
Interesting.
Very exciting. Oh, I'm looking forward to John Syracuse's take.
He's going
to
be...
He's been on about this new programming language, and this feels like a pretty advanced step to take.
I think he'll be very, very happy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So just quickly back, I'll have two more shows. So, you know, don't panic.
Okay, we're going to miss you.
And hopefully we'll get Mika on next week. She's at WWDC right now as we speak, along with Bjorn.
And did you see Bjorn's photo? Have you mentioned that? Bjorn's
We'll put it up on the blog.
Okay. Yeah. Bjorn and a mate
and someone,
over at WWDC.
Someone fairly
special.
Well known.
Someone special.
Yeah.
Scott Forstall?
No, I met Scott Forstall two years ago. Okay. But I think Bjorn's at Dummy.
Okay.
He wins. Very exciting times. Let's go out and play with iOS 8 and
Thanks,
get our hands dirty. Yeah. Thanks,
cool.
guys.
Thanks, Kent. Cheers.
See ya.